come to order, and it is now 1:01 p.m. on Thursday, January 21st of 2016. Members present to my left, we've got Representatives Clayman and Ortiz, Co-Chair Representative Hughes, as well as Representative Nagyak. And I would like to welcome everybody back to Juneau. It feels like we're just here. I guess we're just here in October. Today we'll be hearing a presentation on the Alaska Marine Highway System from Commissioner Mark Lucan and Deputy Commissioner Captain Mike Neusel from the Department of Transportation, Public Facilities on the Alaska Marine Highway System. I'd like anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to be able to do so. So I would ask the committee to hold off on questions as much as possible throughout the presentation so that we can get through it. And then after the presentation, we'll have questions from the committee, and that will be followed by public testimony. And so to those in the room, just a reminder, if you could, if you could turn off your cell phones, that does interfere with the with our audio system. And then also for those of you in the room, if you would like to testify, if you could please sign in. I believe the sign-in sheet is that right outside the door here. So Commissioner Lucan and Deputy Commissioner Neusel, thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself for the record. Go ahead and begin. And Representative Nagyak. Thank you. And for the record, I'd like to recognize that we do have Representative Stutes with us as well. And so, Commissioner Lucan.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Lucan, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. I'm just going to introduce this briefing very shortly, and then I'm going to turn it over to Captain Neusel, who will do the majority of the talking today. I also have to step out. I have another hearing at 1:30, so I'll be leaving a little bit early. This briefing is primarily the briefing that we used when we went out to the six communities in coastal Alaska to talk about the Marine Highway System and to really solicit feedback from those communities around their thoughts about the Marine Highway System and the impacts that the budget cuts have had so far. I just want to emphasize two points that well, maybe three. The first is that, you know, the one thing we learned very, very clearly was, you know, this is a very important part of our transportation system for coastal Alaskans. But in addition, it is really an important part of our transportation system for all of Alaska, and I'll explain why I believe that in just a minute. Secondly, what we heard from these communities is that they are much more interested in reliable, predictable, consistent service to the point where they would even be willing to pay a little bit more for that service, and they would even be willing to accept a little less frequency of servants if the schedule that we publish actually gets sailed every year. And so that was I think a very important point that that we took away. And then second, and then thirdly, and last, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mike, is the fact that if our budget is changed and we have to cancel sailings, it doesn't just hurt the people who have those reservations, who are sailing on those ships. It also significantly impacts the communities, the people that, you know, in your communities who are dependent upon those ships to bring passengers, bring commerce into their communities. And again, it doesn't just impact coastal Alaska. You know, those RVs, those campers, those passengers who are traveling into Skagway and Haines and Whittier aren't traveling to stop there. You know, they're going to continue on into interior Alaska, where they're going to spend money, and they're going to have an impact on the economy of those communities and that part of Alaska as well. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Captain Neusel, and he's going to run through the briefing.
Thank you. Again, if you could just put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Deputy Commissioner Mike Neusel with the Department of Transportation, overseeing the Alaska Marine Highway System. As the Commissioner mentioned, what I'd like to do is just go through the presentation that we used at the community engagement meetings that we held throughout the state, and then answer any of the questions that the committee might have. That would be fine. And we'll use the mouse to point to things on slide rather than the laser pointer, because I don't think the laser pointer is going to work anywhere but there, which isn't going to suffice. Okay. What I'd like to go through is just a mission and profile of the Marine Highway System, some history of where we were, where we are currently, some historical comparisons, some budgetary constraints, talk about what we've done in the fiscal year 16 operating plan, essentially walk you through the process of how we get from a proposed budget to a schedule that people can book reservations on, how that whole process works.
For the record, we do have Representative Sharice Millett here. Thank you for joining us. Please proceed.
Thank you. We'll talk about what we've done in terms of non-service cost reductions and some revenue enhancement ideas, what it looks like going forward in fiscal year 17 and beyond, and then questions and discussions. And added a slide to the presentation. Used to have a slide in it that was a discussion starter at the community engagement meetings to get discussion flowing. Didn't take much prompting to get that going. I've changed that slide to a slide on what we heard, what we learned in those community engagement meetings. We'll go through that at the end.
And also, very quickly, just for the record, I wanted to recognize that we do have Representative Sam Keto in the audience here. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, sir. Good place to start, mission statements for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Keep Alaska moving through service and infrastructure. I key and my staff and the Marine Highway System keys on the word service. We do have a lot of infrastructure with ships and terminals, but we are a front-end service provider. We have direct contact with your constituents, and we have direct contact with really the three main customer groups that the Marine Highway attempts to serve, and that is the residents of Alaska, visitors to Alaska, and commercial shippers who use the Marine Highway System to get their goods and services in and out of Alaska. And it's a balancing act to try and write a schedule that meets the needs of all three of those groups. I'll talk about that more as the presentation goes on. The Alaska Marine Highway System mission statement, a little wordier. I'm not going to read that for you. It's in the packet and on the slide. Essentially provide service and transportation in a cost-effective manner, reliable, safe, and efficient. I do want to point out some specifics of the Alaska Marine Highway System fleet, and the reason I do that is because when it comes time to make hard decisions about what the fleet size should be and what ships should serve what area, there are limitations. Not every ship can go every place because of some differences between the fleet. So I'll start with the top three, the Matanuska, Malaspina, and Taku. Three of the original ships in the fleet, all built in 1963. But you'll notice on the slide that the Matanuska and the Malaspina are different than the Taku, even though they started out life all identical. Matanuska and Malaspina, about 10 years after they were built, were essentially cut in half, lengthened by 50-something odd feet, and added car deck capacity, passenger capacity, and cabin capacity to make them more capable ships. The Taku remained in its original configuration, is much smaller and has less capacity than either the Malaspina or the Matanuska. Another difference that's important to note is the motor vessel Tustamina and the motor vessel Kennecott are unique in that the gantry crane vehicle elevator on the back of the Tustamina and a similar system vehicle elevator that's embedded into the superstructure of the Kennecott, you can't really see it, are unique in that those vessels are the only vessels that can serve anywhere in the system from Homer southward. Homer, Kodiak, Old Harbor, Muzinki, all the way out the Aleutian chain. Because the mooring structures in those communities are fixed docks, they don't float like all tide moorings like we have here and throughout southeast Alaska, those are the only two ships in our fleet that can serve those communities because of that unique vehicle elevator system. That plays into which vessels can be laid up, which vessels have to remain in service in order to continue to provide service. Another unique feature of the Marine Highway fleet that limits ability to send ships certain places is the Aurora and the Leconte. Both of those vessels have a ramp on the stern of the vessel that actually drops onto the shore. Most of our vessels, all except those two actually, use a ramp structure on the shore to drop onto the ship to connect the ship to shore. Places like Pelican, Tetitlik, Chinega Bay, they have a ramp system, dock system, that works with these vessels in that the ramp on the back of the ship actually drops onto the shore to make that connection. So again, I view the work of my scheduler as putting a big jigsaw puzzle together, because all these ships don't fit in all the same places that they need to go.
We do have a question from Representative Co-Chair Shelley Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and I look forward to getting to know you and talk more about this. But one of the questions that's just coming to mind when you're explaining the different vessels and the different kinds of offloading and loading, I'm sure there's different costs and how that compares, and some are more efficient and more effective. And I was just wondering, in the communities and for the type of vessels where it's more expensive, is that figured into the fare in and out of that community, or is that that cost kind of generally put in the big pot and divided up between all?
To the co-chair, I will talk more about our fare structure in the presentation, but generally it's not figured in. We do not have, because our tariff structure is not robust enough at the present time to handle, we do not have unique fares for vessel types. When the fast ferries originally came online, there was a fast ferry surcharge. Hey, we're going to get you there faster. We're going to charge you more to do that. That went by the wayside. I don't know why that left. That has not been reinstituted. And essentially, our fare structure is such that it's the big pool. It is not fare specific per vessel. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about our tariff structure as I go through the presentation. Does that answer your question?
Yes, just a quick follow-up. And when you do, if you could talk about if that might be something that would be considered at some point.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Yep. The last point that I want to make on vessel specifics are the two fast ferries. And again, it's a compatibility issue. They were built, I think, as a cost savings measure with a door only on the forward starboard or right side, not a door on the forward left side. So in places where you can only moor port side two, such as Panicky Springs, these vessels do not work. You can't get them in there. They don't fit. So all sorts of issues associated with vessels and ports. A lack of complete standardization makes the scheduling difficult for the Marine Highway System.
We may be switching it up here a little bit. We may have. So we've got a question from Representative Ortiz, but also I did want to also recognize two former legislators that we have with us here, and that is former Representative Bill Thomas, as well as Senator Albert Kukesh. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Captain Newsom, for being here today. Question, because you were talking about the fast ferries, what is the current status of those two fast ferries? I know that one of the things that, you know, it's kind of, I guess, common knowledge out there is that fuel costs are higher in running those fast ferries, but now that fuel prices are down, does it make those fast ferries more usable and more purposeful for our overall system?
Through the co-chair, Representative Ortiz, it does. The current status of the fast ferries, both of them are in federal capital improvement projects down in Foss Shipyard in Seattle, having maintenance work done on them through a federal project, federally funded. The operating plan for the Chinigas is to keep it in layup status once that project is complete. The Fairweather will be brought back into service beginning of May and operating on a reduced schedule, basically a wintertime type of schedule, which is less expensive to run than a full summertime schedule, the difference being the number of days of week that the vessel operates. So it'll come out beginning of May, operating on a four-day-a-week schedule as opposed to a full seven-day-a-week schedule, which would be typical if we were in the fully funded climate we used to be in.
The Chinega being laid up for an extended period of time, the reasons for that?
Inability to fund its operation. I'll talk to that when I discuss how we get from a budget to a schedule you can book reservations on and how that plays into the to answer your question.
Thank you.
Okay, ports of call. I won't spend a lot of time on this. We operate 35 communities, 33 of them in Alaska. Prince Rupert in British Columbia, Bellingham in Washington. Most people are familiar with our system. There is kind of a distinct split, however, between the Southeast system and the Southwest system, not the least of which is the fact that the docks and the mooring structure are all different in Southwest compared to Southeast, but that the vessels operate on different schedules. The labor contracts that pay those crews and operate those vessels work on different contracts in the Southwest and the Southeast. There are some differences there due to the nature of where they are operating, and I won't go into extreme detail on that. Some statistics from 2015, fiscal year 2015. The Alaska Marine Highway System actually earned a record $53.9 million in revenue. That's up 6% from fiscal year 14. I specifically and intentionally use the word revenue in that line. Most people hear $53.9 million think that we're rolling in money and we can afford to operate the system. None of that $53.9 million is profit. It is revenue that the system generates that is put into the Alaska Marine Highway Fund that is used to roll back in to support the system. But in the next bullet down, you can see that it costs $160 million a year to operate the system. So $53.9 million of revenue is zero profit. It is offsetting cost to operate the system. The rest is made up by an appropriation from the legislature to fund. Second bullet point, we reduced our total operating costs by $5.2 million compared to fiscal year 14, down to $160.8 million. It was $166 million in fiscal year 14. So we're trying to drive the cost down, drive the revenue up, and be more self-sustaining. And I'll talk about that in detail on a future slide. We provided 378 ship weeks of service in fiscal year 15. We measure our service level, if you will, by ship weeks of service. So if every ship of 11 ships in the fleet were running every week of the year with no maintenance and no stops, you'd get 52 times 11 or whatever that works out to, 572 weeks of service. So you can gauge how many, based on that 378 weeks of ship service, you can gauge how many of those ships are running full-time, how many are laid up, how many are not. And we'll talk about that in a bit more detail as we go through a slide. I'll show you the history on that as well. Carried 309,000 plus passengers, 106,000 vehicles. I've got a detailed slide on traffic volume that we carry, and it's pretty stable. That's a pretty stable number. 6,500 or so port calls, pretty stable, slightly down a little bit due to fewer operating weeks, but pretty stable. We redesigned, implemented a new user-friendly, I hope, website, and that new website just yesterday is now able to take reservations for our new reservation system. We are rolling out our new reservation system, and that is available online as of yesterday. And we have quite a few followers on social media, and based on my community engagement meetings, we have a lot of followers in the local communities that are very interested in what the Marine Highway system is and does and becomes. Let's talk about traffic, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clayman?
Through the chair, just curious, if looking at the revenue to total cost, it looks like the revenue that's brought in to operating cost is about a third of the total operating cost.
Through the co-chair, Representative Clayman, yes, that's correct. And I've got a slide that actually points that out, 30-year history on what that cost recovery has been.
And my question was, if you know, and I know you're more on the Marine Highway side of the equation, but if you compare that with the operating costs for the highways, how does that kind of, how does 33%, how do, in terms of direct money coming in through fuel taxes for highways, how does that compare with the total operating cost of highways on a percentage basis? If you know, I'm not sure this is, if you're the Marine Highway guy, that may not be.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Clayman, that's a difficult comparison to make because there's multiple sources of funding for highways that operate highways. And the funding for highways, the gasoline tax that was mentioned earlier, for example, actually that was in a different meeting. Gasoline tax was not mentioned. Those taxes do not roll directly back into the Department of Transportation. The Marine Highway revenue does roll directly back into the Marine Highway system. So it's a bit of an apples to oranges comparison. I don't have those numbers readily available.
Okay. The commissioner may be able to answer that question, but I think he's probably taken off. So thank you.
You're welcome. Traffic report. So this is a 7-year history of the traffic on the...
I'm sorry. Do we have many people who are going to want to testify later? Nobody's... Okay. I think we're concerned that maybe there might be a lot of people that wanted to testify, and so we were going to hold questions until the end, but I think if that's the case right now, then I think we'll go ahead and open it up to questions. I know it's some folks are probably a little bit confused on whether or not we're going to, so we'll go ahead and open it up to committee questions as we go along. So thank you. Please proceed.
Sure. Traffic report, 7-year history of traffic. You can see that the passenger numbers on the top, the vehicle numbers on the bottom stack nicely on top of each other. Our traffic is very stable. We carry the same amount of people and cars year to year on a very consistent basis. And the trends are very consistent also. So you'll notice that in July, August, and June, the summer months, if I can find my mouse pointer, Our traffic volumes are very high, upwards of 60,000 passengers a month in July, our busiest month. In the wintertime, you can see that our traffic volumes decrease very significantly. In the past, the way that we have dealt with this is with an 11-ship fleet, we would run all 11 ships in May or June, certainly in July, August, and in September. And then in the winter months, we would throttle back and either put those ships into maintenance projects, if they were due for maintenance, or put them into a cost savings layup, essentially not operate the ship, put a skeleton crew on it, save money by not operating a ship that we didn't need, and provide the service with a fleet of 4, 5, or 6 of the 11 ships. In the summertime, we would run all of them. So that was when we were fully funded. In the budget challenges that we face and the reduced funding environment that we're in, there are requirement to not operate as many ships. We can't afford to run as many ships as we had in the past. So where do you make those cuts? Where can we reduce service in order to stay within the budget that we're given? In the wintertime, if you're only operating 4 or 5 ships, you can't cut another ship out of that service. Otherwise, you're going to cut somebody off completely. If I'm only running 4 ships and I say, well, I got to take one of those out, you know, Prince William Sound is not going to get service, or Kodiak is not going to get service, or somebody is going to get dropped off completely because those ships are spread as thin as they can be spread. So the only place left to make cuts is in the summertime. So instead of operating 11 ships all summer long, we operated 10 ships last summer and stayed within our budgetary constraints by operating fewer ships in the summer, which is really the only place left to make those cuts. I want to spend some time on this chart because it
We've got a question from Co-Chair Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the weeks of service, 378. You were just talking about the summer months, and it made me think the 378 weeks as opposed to 572 if they were all running. How does that 378 this compare to what it has been historically the last few years?
I have a slide to the co-chair. I have a slide, 2 slides down, that will give you the exact history on that. Okay. So on this chart, historical revenue and operating costs, I looked back 30 years, which is as far back as I could find records in the annual financial reports of the Alaska Marine Highway System, which started being published in 1990, but it had 4 years of previous data in it. And every one of those reports contains 2 essential figures, how much revenue the system generated and how much the system cost to operate. And I plotted that. And the ratio between those two is what gives us our cost recovery, or our fare box recovery is the common industry term, which is the purple line across the top. So back in 1986, the system had about $34 million of revenue generated, and it cost just under $70 million a year to operate, producing a cost recovery in the 50% range, a little bit over 50%. These numbers, by the way, on this chart are not normalized. They're not all set. They are the numbers of dollars for that year out of that report, not manipulated in any way. You can see from 1986 till 2003-2004 timeframe that the revenue that the system generated remained fairly flat. In fact, the revenue that the Marine Highway System generates has been relatively stable over the last 30 years, with a gradual increase but not a significant spike. The operating cost, the dark blue bars, was relatively stable for the first 20 years of this 30-year period, and then has significantly increased from the 2004-05-2006 timeframe onward. Consequently, the cost recovery, or the fare box recovery of this system, which was in the 50 to 60% range up until like 2004, has dropped into the 30% range, where it has remained fairly stable for the last few years. I will note that in 2015, based on trying to increase revenue and decrease costs, we have managed to turn that trend around and start increasing that cost recovery.
And we have a question from Co-Chair Hughes.
Thank you. I see, looking at the chart 1986 to about 2004, that the revenues were, you know, running around half what it cost to operate, and then all of a sudden there's that big jump. And you mentioned that big jump, but can you tell us why? Why did the operating costs go up so significantly after 2004?
To the co-chair, yes, I can. There are a lot of factors as to why that increased. First of all, the price of fuel went up. Second, the price of labor went up. There was a 3-year period where the labor contracts for the state gave significant raises, 5%, 5%, and 6%, I think, for a 3-year period. So the labor costs went up. The fleet size also changed. In 2004, 2005, 2006, the fleet size grew from 9 ships to 11 ships. We added the 2 fast ferries during that time period. So not only are we operating more ships and burning more fuel, but we have more employees, which have more labor costs. So it's compounding. All of those factors, plus increased maintenance costs, contributed to those blue bars escalating.
And follow up, just so I understand the labor cost was due to raises, but also increased number of employees?
That is correct.
And follow up to that, was that increased number of employees only tied to the 2 new vessels coming on board, or were there other employees added?
Through the co-chair, I believe it was just due to the number of increased vessels requiring new crews, more vessels, more crews. I don't know that we added individual employees to crew sizes. I don't have that detail. It is possible that there were crew sizes added. 2001, as you recall, with 9/11 and security requirements, may have increased the number of people on the ships due to security officer requirements.
I just make a comment that I understand from some folks that are retired from the ferry that it seemed like there were a lot of new folks on shore added more and than on the vessels. So I'd like you to comment on that. And then secondly, I understand that there may or may not be standardization as far as the Coast Guard requirements for vessels, because they're in different comparable ferries in the lower 48. The ratio of crew to the size of the boat and number of passengers isn't the same, and Alaska seems to have larger crews. And that I also understand that in the negotiating with the Coast Guards as far as the number of employees for each ferry, that even the unions might be part of that conversation, so that it doesn't sound like it's a strict standard. And that may be bad information I've gotten, but I'd like to know, is there a standard for the number of the crew on shore and on the vessels based on the size of the ship and the passenger ship and everything? And if you can't answer that now, I'd like that information. I think that's important information for us to know, because I understand that, you know, that this impacts families and people, and I've said this last year, I'll repeat it this year for anyone that didn't hear it. I, you know, spent part of my growing up years in Huna. I've got family in Huna, I've got family in Juneau, I've got lots of friends in Southeast. I understand the importance of the ferry, and to tell you the truth, I'd rather my 86-year-old mother get on a ferry than on a plane when the weather's inclement. So I understand the importance of the ferry. And so, you know, I know I'm from South Central and all about roads too, but I just want to make that clear. But I'm really concerned about that huge jump when we're only adding 2 out of 11 vessels, and I don't understand it, and you know, I don't remember fuel, you know, jumping, skyrocketing. It's crept up, yes, but the labor cost just seems out of whack.
Through the co-chair, Representative Hughes, I have some answers to some of those questions on future slides. Let me address a couple of the points that you made, and I will talk specifically about shoreside staff versus vessel staff in terms of numbers. I have a slide on that. In terms of crewing the ships, how many people are on the ships, there's 2 factors that are at play there. One is the certificate of inspection requirement by the U.S. Coast Guard. We're licensed and regulated by the Coast Guard to operate passenger-carrying vessels. Each year, a certificate of inspection is issued to each ship, which specifies a minimum level of crewing to operate the vessel safely. And that's really driven by emergency procedures. How many people does it take to safely abandon ship, man all the life-saving equipment, do all the proper procedures to do that, et cetera. So the certificate of inspection by the Coast Guard mandates a crew size to deal with those things. It does not, however, mandate how many people you need to have cooking food or cleaning staterooms or other ancillary services, passenger services, that the system provides because we have people on board for 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 24, 36 hours on a voyage. So that staffing level is a function of the Marine Highways setting passenger service standards for how many people will be on board to provide meals with an adequate watch rotation, adequate crew rest for the staff that does that. So the certificate of inspection number is not the crew size that you see on a vessel. There's a difference between those two on items that are not regulated by the Coast Guard. Is that answer part of the question for why the crew sizes are different?
Yes, thank you. So another question I have is whether there's been a comparison, even with those added services that you're talking about where it's additional, with other similar vessels in other places. And secondly, is it correct or incorrect that unions are part of that negotiation with the Coast Guard as far as the number of people on the crew?
Through the co-chair, Representative Hughes, for exact comparison, we have not done a item-by-item comparison or a detailed comparison with other ferry providers. We have a kind of a unique system. BC Ferries, I think, has some similarities to us. They do have some long runs up to Prince Rupert from Port Hardy. But other than that, the ferry systems in the United States are generally short-haul ferries. You get on one side of Puget Sound, you get off on the other 30 minutes later. You don't have a requirement for a food service, really, or staterooms or cabins or those types of amenities. We run a much longer route system, and we have passengers on board for a much longer period of time that do require, in terms of just passenger service and taking care of people, a necessity to have people provide those services. So there's a difference there. I'm sorry, I forgot the second half of your question.
Whether the unions are...
Yes. Through the co-chair, Representative Hughes, the unions, whether they communicate with the Coast Guard on crewing requirements, I don't know. That's between the union and the Coast Guard. That's not a Marine Highways function. I do know that we negotiate with our labor unions to provide adequate staffing and crewing on the vessels, and there are requirements in those collective bargaining agreements for what mandatory crew sizes happen during certain events, shipyard periods, those types of things, and who gets assigned versus not if there's a reduction in force, you know, what the pecking order is in terms of seniority, those types of things. That is in our negotiated agreements with the unions. That's not a Coast Guard requirement. That's a collective bargaining agreement requirement between us and our labor force.
Follow-up, and then...
Yeah, and I'll keep it short just because we're on the labor. I understand there's one segment of ferry employees under one part of a union or a union that is still under defined... benefits as opposed to defined contribution, but it's not real clear because it's paid in a lump sum, I understand. So I'm just wondering, I mean, it'd be great if everybody could be on defined benefit, but we're not at that stage, and what we're facing, it seems like that is something that should be considered. Is that something that will be considered in the future with that particular segment of employees?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, the retirement plan contributions for our three different maritime unions are all different, and I would like nothing more than like you to have that be standardized and simplified. And I know we have some union representatives in the room who have been in the community meetings with me, by and large, as well, who have heard me say consistently that we need to simplify our contracts. They are complex, they are difficult to understand and difficult to administer, but they are negotiated contracts, and it takes negotiation to change them, and we are working that direction, but it is not a fast process.
Thank you.
I would like to recognize in the audience we have Representative Liz Vasquez. Thank you for joining us. And so we've got questions next from Representative Stutes and then Klayman.
Just on the last point, you keep mentioning unions. How many unions are involved in the operation of the ferries?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, there's three maritime unions. I have a slide that actually lists every union and how many employees are in that.
I can wait.
In that
Thank
thing.
You.
So two slides down the road, or four slides down the road, we'll get to that.
Thank you.
Next, we've got Representative Klayman, and then after that, Representative Negyek.
In 2005, 2006, 2007, when fuel costs went up and labor costs went up, do you know whether the actual wage rates went up more than 1 or 2%, or was it primarily the number of employees that went up that caused the rate increase in rates, if you're familiar with the contracts that were in place or negotiated at that time?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, I do not have the specifics on that. I have been led to believe that there was our union contracts go on three-year cycles, and I understand that during one of those three-year cycles, when the state had a lot of money and was paying employees more, that there was a 5.5%, 6.7% increase raise across the board for, and I'm not sure it was just maritime unions. It might have been more widespread than that. But for the maritime unions, there was a significant pay raise during that three-year period during that contract negotiation. Thank you.
And we've got a question from Representative Negak.
Well, we're at the cost, operating costs and stuff. I know there's new generation of motors out there, different kind of motors use less fuel and stuff with. Is there any thought to replacing some of those engines instead of, using the same ones that use a lot of fuel and maybe reduce the cost of operating each vessel?
Through the chair, Representative Nagyak. Yes, sir. We have repowered some of our vessels with more fuel-efficient engines. The Columbia recently got new engines in it that use less fuel. We're still collecting data to determine how much less fuel. We have plans in the works to repower the motor vessel Matanuska with more fuel-efficient engines as well, in terms of trying to use less fuel and save money.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Okay. Back to the slide. I think we've covered this one enough. I do want to note again, though, that fiscal year 15, we have driven the blue bar down, reduced cost. We have driven the red bar up to increase revenue, and our cost recovery or our fare box recovery rate for 2015 was at 33.5%. So that is on an upward trend. My goal and my mission is to keep making sure that continues on an upward trend. This is some historical, for the same period, 30 years, ridership or traffic volumes. On the top, the squiggly blue line is the number of passengers that we've carried. The purple line through that is a mathematical normalized average. You can see that we're on a downward trend in terms of passengers. I attribute that to the fact that air transportation, which competes with us for strictly passenger traffic, has become much more reliable and much more available in the present time than it was 30 years ago. You can fly a lot more places much more quickly than you can take a ferry there and back. I think that has affected our passenger traffic. Our vehicle traffic, however, on the bottom, the red line shows actual vehicle traffic. The orange line through it is a mathematical average, is virtually a straight line. We carry between 100 and 110,000 vehicles every year on this system and have for the past 30 years. That is pretty much a constant. And if you remember the previous slide and this slide, we'll do one more, and then I'll tie all three of them together for you.
We've got a question from Co-Chair Hughes.
A very, very simple, quick one. I'm just wondering if the increased cruise traffic has impacted also, because people before didn't have that option, and they might decide they want all the fancy food and amenities of a cruise ship. Perhaps that's caused the decrease.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hughes, quite possible that was a factor as well. And thanks for pointing that out, because I hadn't mentioned that before, but you're right. The cruise industry has expanded greatly in the last 30 years, and I'm sure some people that took a cruise on the Marine Highway System now take cruises on cruise ships. Okay, one more slide, and then we'll tie all three of these together. This is the historical operating weeks and the fleet size. So at the top of this, in fiscal year 2000, I didn't go back 30 years on this because I don't have the actual numbers back to then, but in 2000, we operated about a 300-week schedule, and we did that with 9 ships. We used to have the Bartlett. We did not used to have 2 fast ferries or the Lituya. We had a 9-ship fleet. We ran a 300-week schedule for 2000 to 2004. In 2005, our fleet makeup started changing. The 2 fast ferries came online. The Bartlett was decommissioned. Lituya came online. We turned into an 11-ship fleet, and with those 11 ships and funding to operate them, we started providing more service. We went from a 300-week schedule to a 400-week schedule, essentially, for the mid-2000s, up to a record 427 weeks of service in 2007, all with 11 ships. In the recent past, 2013 was a 400-week schedule. In 2014, we did 377 weeks. 2015, I mentioned we did 378 weeks. This year, we're scheduled to do 357 or 358 weeks. The plan for fiscal year 17 is down to about a 320-week schedule. We are essentially going back to, because of funding, going back to a level of service that we provided in the early 2000s. However, we're not going back, at least we haven't yet, gone back to the same fleet size. We used to have 9 ships. Now we have 11 ships. We still have 11 ships, even though we're running a reduced schedule down from the 400-week average that we normally run.
We've got two questions. Okay. Our first question is from Representative Ortiz and then Co-Chair Hughes.
So would you say then that the main reason why the operating costs have been brought down over the last couple of years is in direct relationship to reduced weeks of service? Is that pretty much the main reason why those costs have been reduced?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, that is one of the reasons. There are others, and I have a slide that points out some of the other cost reduction measures that we've taken to try and save money and reduce costs.
And can you give us just a little, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, could you give us a little quick overview of what those reduced weeks of service mean specifically in a couple of cases anyway, less service to this community or less service to that community?
Through the Chair, Representative Ortiz, I can. The there is a process we use to determine where we can reduce service. If budget cuts come such that we cannot operate the 400-week schedule that we normally operate, and clearly we're not in that mode anymore, there are ways you can cut service without cutting people off from service. And that's why I mentioned the unique vessels at the beginning. So, for example, and this is probably best described by example, I cannot say, okay, let's do a cost savings layup. Let's put the Testamina in layup for 6 weeks or 6 months and save money. I can't do that because I would cut off the entire Southwest system. It's the only ship that serves that system. In contrast, if you look at Prince William Sound, that was typically served by two vessels, the Aurora and a fast ferry. Both vessels serving the majority of the communities in there. One vessel can't go into one, but that's a minor issue. Could I make cuts there? Yes, we can reduce that service to one vessel in Prince William Sound instead of two vessels in Prince William Sound as a cost savings measure and still provide service to all the communities there. Less frequent, less capacity, but still service without eliminating somebody completely from the system. The same logic holds down in Southeast. And for your district, the Taku and the Matanuska both used to go to Prince Rupert. They would essentially compete with each other for traffic out of Prince Rupert. We put the Taku into layup and forced essentially all that traffic onto the Matanuska. It's carried at all. We've not left people behind on the dock that we haven't been able to carry. We just go there less frequently, don't provide as much capacity, but we're still meeting the demand for the capacity that we do provide there. That answer your question?
Sure.
Okay. I have more slides that we'll talk about that in a minute.
We've got a question from Co-Chair Hughes.
So looking 2017, you're estimating you'll be down to about 320 operating weeks. That's similar to 2004, 2005 in there. You were using 9 vessels then, but you're still planning, I understand, using 11. And I'm just wondering what would the savings and could you do something similar? And I know you were kind of talking to Representative Ortiz about that, but it seems like it could save a lot to go back to the 9. And then also, I was just wondering what the population and the capacity comparison are. My understanding in recent years is the population in most of the ferry communities has gone down a bit. So are we pretty similar in population, do you know, as we were in 2004, 2005? In other words, the amount of service back then, if we go to 320 weeks, is it going to be pretty comparable as far as meeting the needs of based on population?
Through the co-chair, to the co-chair, Representative Hughes, in terms of the number of ships, the answer is yes. I when I tie these three slides together in a moment, I make the argument that we have more ships than we need. We have more ships than we can afford, and therefore we should scale back the size of the Marine Highway fleet to save money. Because even a ship in layup costs money. There's still skeleton crew on it. It still has some expenses, and depending where it's tied up, those expenses could be more significant. In terms of population in the communities we serve, I have not gone back and looked at historical populations. I don't think the population of Southeast Alaska has changed significantly. Most of the population growth, just off the top of my head, has been in the interior of Alaska Rail Belt communities, Anchorage, Matsu Valley-type spaces. I don't think there's been significant population changes within the Marine Highway communities that we serve.
Ola?
I just want to make a comment. I think, and this is not just regarding the ferry system and transportation, but the services that we receive as Alaskans. When I think back in general to 10 or so years ago, I don't remember it being particularly bad or a crisis. I don't remember, of course, I didn't live in Southeast at that time, but I don't remember hearing from my family members that it was just absolutely horrible and just we had to do something and it was just awful, awful. I don't remember that. And so I just think in general we all need, as we are approaching these next few years, to be thinking, you know, 10 years ago it wasn't quite so bad. There weren't any huge gaps. You know, we had a pretty good state 10 years ago. So I just encourage my family and friends and all those in Southeast to realize, you know, we can do this. It's going to be okay. You'll still be able to get from point A to point B. We did it back in 2004, 2005. We can do it again. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So if you remember the previous three slides, and I'll just click to them briefly. So our cost and revenue, that history, the traffic ridership, and the fleet size and weeks of service, I would summarize those three slides by this analogy. We have taken essentially a fixed amount of traffic, since our traffic numbers are relatively stable, that used to be fit and forced onto a nine-ship fleet with a 300-week schedule, and we have diluted that and spread that out over an 11-ship fleet and a 400-week schedule with no significant increase in either ridership or revenue generated, but a lot more cost because it takes more money to operate 11 ships than it does 9 ships. The situation we find ourselves in now with the fiscal challenges that the state faces and the funding available to run a marine highway system is that that schedule is shrinking back to the 300 weeks of service. The fleet size, in my estimation or opinion, needs to start shrinking back somewhat as well, not to mention the fact that we have new vessels in the process coming online. We will need to divest of some vessels sooner, maybe rather than later, and we are looking at that strongly. There's plans in the works for that.
We've got a question from Representative Clayman.
So on that downsizing the fleet size, and I have enjoyed crossing Prince William Sound every summer, sometimes on the Chenega and sometimes on the Aurora, and often talking with the crew to kind of learn more about operations. And I keep getting this general sense when you talk about the fleet's oversized. I look back historically. It seems like in ways all this really started when we decided to add these two fast ferries, and that ever since we added the fast ferries, we've had a lot more problems, not only with maintenance issues on the fast ferries, but I keep having this question, maybe we should be selling the fast ferries first. I know you're talking about do we let sell certain assets, but it certainly seems like those maybe should be at the top of the list to consider if we're downsizing.
Through the co-chair, Representative Clayman, that's certainly an option. Right now, I think, and I'll show you the operating chart for fiscal 16, the motor vessel Taku has been laid up since last June for a variety of reasons, and I'll explain those, and is forecast to remain laid up for the indefinite future. I don't have a return service date for that vessel. Based on its smaller size, as I discussed at the beginning of my presentation, and less capacity on that vessel, and its age, 53 plus years old, it is a logical candidate for a fleet reduction vessel. The fast ferries might be candidates. In fact, we have plans to keep one of them laid up for an extended period of time due to operating costs. But I think this pertains to what Representative Hughes mentioned, is that we used to operate with a nine-ship fleet, and we have become accustomed as a state and as a consumer base to an 11-ship fleet, and we've been accustomed to more frequent service and more frequent port calls, and Prince William Sound in particular has grown accustomed to having a fast ferry serve the connection between Cordova and Whittier. It's very easy to go and provide more service. If the funds are there, it's very easy to say, hey, we're going to give you 6 port calls a week instead of 4 port calls a week. People accept that without challenge. It's much, much, much more difficult to tell that community, hey, you used to get 6 days a week service, now we're cutting back, you're only going to get 4 days a week service or 2 days a week service, because businesses and enterprises and the local community and tourists have all grown accustomed to and based their business models around that service. So cutting back on that service not only hurts the individual passenger that rides that vessel, but all those ancillary businesses that extend throughout the state, not just in that local community, that no longer have that service and that source of revenue coming into their community.
A question from Representative Ortiz.
And during this time that we see these increased costs, we added on some ships, but do we also add on actual ports, new ports that we weren't serving in the past that we started to serve? Was that a part of it as well?
Through the co-chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, and we've reduced some ports. So in the recent past, we have added the ports of Uzinki near Kodiak and Gustavus here in Southeast. We have eliminated the port of Seward. We no longer serve the port of Seward. We have heard, and I've heard many times, that the Marine Highway System should not provide service to places where there's roads that provide service. And that is true, and that's, I think, a large reason why we don't go to Seward anymore. It was a long ways out of the way, took a long time to get there, and Seward is connected by road to Homer and to Whittier. Why do we provide ferry service to all three of those places? We don't anymore. Uzinki is an island community. They have no road service. We sailed right by there. They have a dock that's compatible with the Testamina. We provided service there at very little additional cost to provide that service, and we connected another community to the system. Same thing with Gustavus. We are fairly close to Gustavus with a dock there. We can provide service there as well. It's interesting that Gustavus, I think there was some initial opposition to having the ferry service come there, but since we have come there, now it's hard to pull back out. You can't say, well, we used to go there. We didn't used to go there. We'll stop going there. We can't do that. People have grown accustomed to that. Business models have been built on that. It's not something you can just back out ports that have been added based on seniority as to when they were added to the system. That question actually came up during one of the community meetings I attended. That answer your question?
Yep. So. Thank you very much.
And we've got two questions. First question is coming from Representative Stutes and then Co-Chair Hughes.
Well, I was going to try and hold back on this, but since you mentioned the Testamina, I understand that we're reducing the size, or the intent is to reduce the size of the fleet and cut the costs. But the fact is, there's only a certain number of your of the ships that will go out the chain, and it's been well publicized and well said that the Testamina is on its short life. So, where is that? I mean, where is the projection of the replacement of the Testamina? Because that would certainly leave a lot of those communities out in that direction at a loss for service.
Fico Chair, Representative Stutes, you are correct. We like to say that Testamina is approaching its twilight years. It's not there yet. It's still a safe vessel. I don't want anybody to think that it is not. We sailed it across the Gulf of Alaska twice. We're going to do it again next week to transport vehicles to Juneau. So that vessel is approaching the end of its service life. It's had a hard life in its operating environment and has provided a lot of service for 53 plus years. The replacement vessel, Testamina replacement vessel, still unnamed, has just completed the design process. Our contractor, Gloston Associates, has just completed the design on that vessel. It's en route to me right now. Me and my staff will be reviewing that. The process for actually constructing that vessel is the next step, and that's part of the STIP process, Statewide Transportation Improvement Plan. The Testamina replacement vessel is listed in the current STIP, but it's listed as a fiscal year 19 and beyond project. It's my opinion that we can't wait till fiscal year 19 to start construction on that vessel. We need to pull that forward. That is being worked on through the amendment process of the STIP to figure out a way to pull that forward and to get that vessel under construction so that we can replace, one for one, the Testamina with a Testamina replacement vessel. That will have, does two things. A, it doubles the capacity in terms of the number of vehicles and people that can be carried, which is a good thing for that region. And B, it fits at every dock that we currently send the Testamina to, so we don't need to rebuild a bunch of infrastructure to be compatible with that ship.
Well, I certainly appreciate that, and you've made me a very happy legislator today.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you. You've mentioned the fast ferries a couple times, and I know you've mentioned even the names of the vessels, but for clarification, if you could tell me the names of the two fast ferries and the communities that they go back and forth. I think you said Whittier and Cordova was one route. But my main question about fast ferries that I'd like to understand is their cost to operate. As you know, is it good? Is it better? And in some place, does it make more sense based on the ridership and the number of people? So Representative Klainman was suggesting perhaps those are the ones that should be eliminated, but I want to understand it better because I thought there were some efficiencies that we gained through them. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Hughes, correct. Let me answer the first part of your question. So the two fast ferries are the Fairweather and the Chinigo, the names of the vessels. I'll start with the second one first. The Chinigo is homeported, as listed on the stern of the vessel, in Cordova, Alaska. There's a fast ferry support facility in Cordova. That's its home port. And it typically operates in Prince William Sound. The fast ferry Fairweather is homeported in Juneau, has a support building and a stern berth here in Auk Bay. And it typically operates either upland canal or down to Sitka or Petersburg. Those vessels are not immediately available to go to any community at will because of route certifications and special training and Coast Guard certifications that have to be met before you can go there. I can't just say, hey, we're going to take the fast ferry Fairweather and sail to Ketchikan today because I don't have a route certified crew to carry passengers to do that. So Chinigo, typically route certified, Cordova, Whittier, Valdez routes. Fairweather is down in southeast Alaska, either upland canal to Haines and Skagway, down to Sitka. It can go to Angoon, and it can go to Petersburg, but due to dock issues, there's other places in southeast Alaska that we cannot go with that vessel. In terms of cost to operate, that's a trade-off, and I don't have the specific numbers in front of me. We can certainly get those, the typical operating cost per week for those vessels, but let me throw a couple things out because there's a misconception, I think, that it's a fast ferry, it burns fuel like it's going out of style, and it's expensive to operate. While that's true, it does burn a lot of fuel, it burns that fuel for a much shorter amount of time because it gets to its destination twice as quick as a typical ferry would get there. And the crew size on that vessel, since it operates for a shorter amount of time, is many fewer people than what you typically find on a mainliner in terms of the crew size. So the operating cost, when you factor in all of those factors, is not necessarily that different from a mainliner. But we can get you those specific numbers if you're interested in those.
And then
we have a follow-up, and then Representative Stutes afterwards.
And can you explain how a fast ferry compares to what we're calling the day ferries?
Yes. So a fast ferry is a classification of vessel that, through the chair, Representative Hughes, excuse me. A fast ferry is a classification of vessel that operates at high speed. It follows the high speed code. Our fast ferries typically operate 32, 34 knots. A typical mainline ferry is in the 12 to 15 knot range, so it's twice as fast. A day ferry or a day boat is a scheduling requirement. So the fast ferries are day boats in that they have no accommodations for overnight passengers or crew. Their typical mission profile is to leave a port, go to a destination, and come back to that port, maybe multiple times or hit several ports and come back. But the general operating mode is to return to the port of origin each day after a 12-hour shift, which is what the crew can operate on due to crew work rest standards. A mainliner, which has crew accommodations and passenger accommodations on some of them, but crew accommodations, can operate around the clock, or it doesn't have to return to the same port. It could run like the Columbia does. It runs continually from Bellingham up to Skagway and then back to Bellingham on a weekly cycle, and it does that continually. It doesn't return to a home port and have a crew that works just a day shift, where the term day boat comes from.
And follow up. Okay. So day ferry and fast ferry, are those interchangeable? The day ferries always go twice the speed as a mainliner, or not necessarily?
Those terms are not interchangeable, and we should be careful how we use them. So a fast ferry specifically refers to the two high-speed ferries that we have, the Chinigo and the Fairweather. A day boat can be a fast ferry. It is the fast ferries. They are day boats, but they can also be a typical conventional vessel. The Lituya, for example, down in Metlakatla, is a day boat. It doesn't operate for more than 12 hours in a day. The Aurora and the Chinigo could operate as day boats. The Alaska-class ferries will be day boats. They do not have crew quarters on them. They will have a 12-hour operating day limit for how long that crew can operate that vessel before returning to port and resting.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
And we've got questions from Representative Stutes and then Nagyak.
Thank you. This is on the fast ferries. Am I in the understanding correctly that there's some real significant issues in running those, say, out of Cordova with the weather situation, when that's their only mode of transportation and the wind starts to blow, which it does down there, they simply can't go. And that seems to be a significant problem with those fast ferries. Am I correct in understanding that?
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, there are more stringent weather limitations on the fast ferries than there are on our conventional hulled vessels. They do cancel for weather more often. Our typical operating model has had the fast ferries operating in the summertime when the weather is generally nicer. We don't exceed those wave height limits and have them laid up for cost savings measures in the wintertime, as I mentioned, with our traffic curve and how we typically responded to that. This past year, we had some additional limitations, more stringent limitations, put on the two fast ferries because of some corrosion on the hulls. We had operating limitations imposed based on an analysis of that corrosion. That damage is scheduled to be fixed during the current federal projects that these vessels are in to replace that damaged hull section and then reinstate the normal operating limits for the fast ferries as opposed to the reduced operating limits. We saw some cancellations this past summer due to those reduced operating limits that we would not normally have seen.
So follow up just once. Thank you. So what I'm hearing is you will continue depending to run the fast ferries just in the summer months when the weather is conducive to them, and then lay them up in the winter time so those communities won't have to try and depend on them in the winter time.
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, that's correct. There's a lot of variables that goes into
correct.
That.
Correct. So. I understand that. Thank you.
Representative Nagyek.
How many ports of origin do you have in the system?
Through the chair, Representative Nagyek, ports of origin? Uh-huh. 35. There's 35 places that you can get on a Alaska Marine Highway system.
But what I meant is how many do you have that, you know, between the communities that stay over, or you know, their home port or whatever.
How many home ports do we have for the vessels? I don't know the numbers. I can give you kind of the rundown. So the Tustamina home ports, essentially out of Homer. One of the fast ferries, the Chiniga out of Cordova. The Aurora home ports out of Valdez, typically. And then in Southeast, there's a variety. The Fairweather out of Juneau. Kennecott, Columbia, Matanuska out of Ketchikan, the Leconte is out of Juneau. So mainly our home ports, Ketchikan, Juneau, Valdez, Cordova, and Homer are the main, we call them change ports. That's where the crew changes happen. That's where the vessel essentially bases out of.
Thank you.
Okay, let me continue with the presentation. Like I said, we're going back to a 300-week schedule. We still have 11 ships. That's going to be a challenge for us. We need to address that. I want to walk you through the process for how we get from a budget proposal to a schedule that people are booking reservations on, and some of the risks associated with that process. So every July or August, the department meets with the Office of Management and Budget at what we call our heads-up meeting to give them a heads-up on what we're looking at budget-wise. And we come into that meeting, the Marine Highway System comes into that meeting with a proposal and some options. Option A is 340 weeks of service. Option B is 320 weeks of service. Option C is 300 weeks of service. And each of those options has a cost associated with it. Based on the expected budget and the funding levels that look likely given the totality of the state budget situation, in meetings with OMB and discussions between OMB and the governor, we get direction to proceed with a certain option that has a certain number of weeks of service and to expect funding for that option. And that's what is submitted as part of the governor's budget proposal. This year, the governor's budget proposal has the 320 weeks of service operating plan. From that, we developed this operating plan, and this is the fiscal year 16 operating plan on the screen right now, that's made up of all the vessels along the left-hand side, our 11-ship fleet, the months of the year, the fiscal year, and then filled in with. We know when certain maintenance projects are going to happen. For example, the Columbia is in a capital improvement project right now, federal capital improvement project. We know when that's going to be, so we block that out on this bar chart, basically. Same with the Fairweather, same with the Chiniga. We fill in the rest of the vessels with the yellow bars of service and try to meet all of our routes and provide service to all of our ports. And where we can't do that, we put vessels into a cost savings layup, the dark blue bars. You'll notice, and I mentioned before, that Tataku has a dark blue bar all the way across. We do not plan to operate that vessel this year. We are essentially a 10-ship fleet right now, except we're still paying a lot of money to keep the Tataku because there's still a partial crew on it, and we're paying to keep the vessel safe and insurance and all those things. But generally speaking, we lay that out on the operating plan, provide service, try to eliminate gaps. We don't want to have a gap in service someplace like we had scheduled for up in Prince William Sound, because vessels have to cycle through their annual overhaul period to get their certificate of inspection renewed. We take this operating plan, and from that, the scheduler develops a schedule. She knows what vessels that she has available that are in service. She knows what routes need to be met. She writes the schedule that puts those vessels on those routes. We take that draft schedule, we put that out to the public, give them a 2, 3, or 4 week public comment period that we accept comments back on that schedule, and then we hold a public scheduling teleconference to allow folks to call in and tell us whether that schedule meets our needs, doesn't meet their needs, or what they would suggest we do differently. Based on that feedback, we make changes to that schedule where we can, where it makes sense to do so, and then we publish a final schedule that the public can book their travel on. That process works fairly well in the winter for the winter schedule. It's very challenging for the summer for this very reason. We typically publish our summer schedule, which covers the months of May, June, July, August, and September, a 5-month period in the summer. We typically want to publish that schedule in October, to give tourists and visitors and residents time to know what the schedule is, be able to book that far in advance, make their reservations, plan their trips, encourage visiting to Alaska, and put that schedule out in a manner that's available to the public. Well, we don't have our budget for the 3 months of that 5-month period until after legislative session, which is not until April, if session ends in April. Right? So we put out a summer schedule, and we just did this last January. We put out the summer schedule for summer of 2016. We put out a summer schedule that has 3 months of that schedule based on an assumed budget, which is a risky thing to do. When budgets are status quo, that seemed to make perfect sense. People like getting the schedule early. The budget wasn't subject to change much. That was all well and good. Last year, we learned very painfully that when budget reductions happen on a schedule that's already been published and sold, it's very challenging to then go back and say, whoops, sorry, we thought we were going to sail the ship on this day and this time, and we know you already bought a ticket on it, but I'm sorry, the state can't afford to do that. We're going to cancel that. That was a very trying situation last summer. We didn't do that to the extent that we thought we were going to have to, because we found one-time money, excess fuel trigger money, that essentially bailed out our summer schedule. But we are potentially in that situation again this year. We have published a schedule based on the governor's budget and what he has requested for the Marine Highway System, which is a reduction from last year. There is a $5.3 million operating fund reduction. I'll talk about that on the next slide. In the governor's budget, we wrote a schedule based on that assumed cut and published that schedule and are now taking reservations on that. 3 months of that schedule are unfunded, essentially, until this legislative session convenes and the operating budget is finalized. So there's a risk factor there. Like I said, the winter schedule works a little bit easier. There's fewer ships, there's fewer people scheduling it, and it doesn't span a budget fiscal year, so it's a little bit easier to do. That is how we get from a operating plan to a schedule and the budget. I want to talk about funding a little bit because this is kind of a key topic. This is the budget progression of the Alaska Marine Highway System from fiscal year 10 through fiscal year 16. And I'll draw your attention to the red box first. This is general fund allocation for the Marine Highway System, undesignated general funds. This is essentially the funding that the legislature provides to operate the Marine Highway System in addition to the revenue that the system generates to operate itself. Okay. Some people use the term subsidy. It's not really a subsidy. The state doesn't subsidize itself. It is the funding that the state provides to provide the Marine Highway Service. You can see in fiscal year 13 that funding was $123.7 million. In fiscal year 14, it dropped to $116 million. In fiscal 15, it dropped to $112 million. This year, it is $96 million. In the governor's requested budget for fiscal year 17, it's $92 million. Okay? We've taken a $31 million budget cut over 5 years in undesignated general funds and have adjusted the system to accommodate for that by providing less service, making some cuts and reductions, and I got a slide that'll go through those. But we live within the means of the budget, and there's some significant budget cuts that have happened since then. Also, so that's on the operating fund side. There's really like four different buckets of money that the Marine Highway System taps into. The operating side, the undesignated general fund, is one of those sources of funding. Another source of funding is the capital funding, general fund, but capital funding, that is money used to do overhauls and maintenance on the vessels and deferred maintenance. You can see in fiscal year 13, that was a $15 million fund revenue stream for the Marine Highway System. We overhauled and got certificates of inspection renewed on all 11 ships with that $15 million and maintained our terminals. In fiscal year 14, that was a $14.8 million budget line item. Again, we overhauled all 11 ships, got certificates of inspections renewed, maintained our terminals, and operated. In fiscal year 15, it's essentially the same amount of money, $14.5 million, but strange things happened in fiscal year 15, and we did not overhaul all 11 ships, and we did not obtain certificates of inspection on all 11 ships, because when it came time for the 11th ship in the line that year, which was the motor vessel Taku, to get its overhaul done, we were out of capital funding. We did not have the funding to do the overhaul and get the certificate of inspection renewed. Now, that shortfall in funding, even though it's the same amount, was not due to mismanagement. It was due to the fact that every vessel that got overhauled before the Taku, the other 10 ships in the fleet, all had discovery work and cost more than expected. So a ship goes into an overhaul period, certain inspections get done, certain things get found, wasted steel, rust, corrosion, etc. The Coast Guard says, you're going to have to fix that before we're going to issue you a certificate of inspection, otherwise you're not going to sail. You have to fix it. It costs more money. It takes more time. Ships came out of overhaul late. That causes schedule disruptions. Ships cost more money than we planned. We ran out of capital funding. And in essence, we put the Taku into layup because we could not afford to overhaul it and get its certificate of inspection renewed. You can see that in fiscal year 16, that overhaul and maintenance funding dropped from $14.5 million down to $10.5 million. There is no way that we're going to get 11 certificates of inspection, 11 overhauls done on 11 ships at $10.6 million, which is why the Taku remains in layup status and is not planned to return to service. The governor's request for fiscal year 17, budget request for that, is back to the $12 million of overhaul, $3 million of deferred maintenance for a $15 million typical funding for our capital maintenance projects. Two other points I want to make on this slide that I think address questions that were brought up earlier about the size of staff, shoreside, and maintenance, and on vessels. So this section of the chart deals with marine vessel operations. The next slide, section down, deals with shoreside costs. And if you look at the fiscal year 16 breakdown on those costs, 88% of the operating cost of the Marine Highway System is directly related to marine vessel operations. The labor, the fuel, the travel, the commodities, the food, the sheets, all the supplies that keep our vessels going make up 88% of our budget. The other 12% of our budget is the entire shoreside cost, all the overhead, if you will, if you use that term. But that's not really overhead, because included in that shoreside cost are all the terminals and all the terminal staff that essentially complete the link between the ships and the shore. They are not really overhead. They're essential components of the system to ticket, stage, line up passengers, manage that whole end of the business. So 88% of our budget is direct marine vessel operations. 12% of our budget goes to everything else. Shore operations, vessel ops management, reservations, marketing, the engineering staff down in Ketchikan, overhead, all those types of things. Okay, it's not out of line in terms of the amount of overhead that the Marine Highway System has in terms of budget.
Got a question from Representative Hughes and then Stutes.
Thank you. Just while you're talking about explaining the shore versus the vessel labor, I have a question related to the labor, and that is, do we have employees on the ferries, in the ferry system, that live out of state and that are receiving the cost of living adjustment, the COLA?
Through the chair, to Co-Chair Hughes, we do. On the next slide, I'll give you the exact details on how many people that is and what percentage of workforce that is.
And while we're doing that, I remember, I'm pretty sure it was last year there was talk. Oh, follow up, please. There was going to be the removal of the free pass type of benefit, and has that been implemented? I know that's, you know, a relatively small piece in the overall picture, and just wondering if we're keeping tabs on that, and as far as employees not taking someone else's car, you know, or something like that. The small potatoes, but in this time that Alaska's facing, we even have to consider the small potatoes.
Through the co-chair, Representative Hughes, yes, we are keeping track of that, and no, we have not implemented that, and there's a reason for that. Let me explain that. In the negotiation session for each of our three maritime unions, we negotiated in a $100 fee for the annual pass that employees used to have for free. That has not yet been implemented because not all three of our maritime contracts have been signed and finalized. The Marine Engineering Beneficial Association, our engineers contract, is still unsigned. So we cannot implement that $100 fee on that contract, and out of a desire to be able to manage this, we elected not to implement it on the other two unions. It was intended to be implemented all three at the same time. Since one union still does not have a negotiated agreement signed to allow us to be able to implement that fee, we have not implemented it anywhere.
We've got a question from Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Along the line of my Representative Hughes' question, when we have when you have employees that live out of state, is that employee responsible for their own travel costs going and coming from and to the state of Alaska?
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, the general answer is yes, but not in every instance. And let me give you some examples, because it's complicated. So generally speaking, if an employee has a bid position on a ship, let's say that an employee bids as, I want to be the master on the Leconte, and based on their seniority and experience and training and qualifications, they meet all the requirements for that, and they are assigned as the master on the Leconte as a bid position, they are responsible to get themselves to and from work. So even if that employee who bid that position lives in Seattle, to show up for his two-week assignment every other two-week period, travel to and from Juneau is on their dime, not the state's. However, if we take an employee that has necessary qualifications, training, pilotage, route certifications, whatever the case may be, and need them to fill in an emergency basis on another ship, and it's not their normal bid position, we will pay their travel from their change port to their temporary assignment port. So we're not paying from Bellingham to a temporary assignment in Valdez, for example, if their change port was Juneau. We would pay from Juneau to Valdez. The rest of that expense would be on the employee.
Thank you.
And we have worked really hard to make sure that everybody has an identified change port per the contract in the recent past.
Thank you.
Okay, we've talked about this a lot. This is the slide that will answer a lot of the questions that have come up so far. So this is workforce statistics for the Marine Highway System. The first question is on what unions are represented by the Marine Highway System. On the vessels, we have three different unions, the IBU, Inland Boatman's Union, MEBA, Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, and MMP, Masters, Mates, and Pilot Union. Those three unions represent all of the employees that work on our vessels, one of those three unions. On the shore side, we have four different unions and then exempt employees. So most of our employees are in the general government union, all of the terminal agents, all of the reservations clerks, most of the folks that work down in Ketchikan Central Office are all in the general government union. Supervisors, the lead person at each ferry terminal, some of the folks down in Ketchikan who have supervisory duties fall under the supervisory union, and then we have a handful of labor, trades, and crafts and confidential union employees. Labor, trades, and crafts are the shoreside maintenance team that's based down in Ketchikan that does the maintenance on the terminal docks, hydraulic systems, ramps, transfer bridges, lighting, the terminal buildings themselves, seven folks in that role. And then the confidential union are basically our dispatchers that deal with a lot of personal information of the employees in terms of dispatch and home phone numbers and home email addresses and all that kind of stuff. They're in the confidential union. The exempt employees, I will give you a rundown on those. There's five of them within the Marine Highway system. I am one of them. My direct report, the general manager of the system, Captain Falvey, is the second, and then his three direct reports, the operations manager, the engineering manager, and the business manager, are all exempt employees. Those five make up the total exempt employees for the Marine Highway system.
And we've got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the previous slide, I'm looking at the general fund allocation from, looks like the high year was $123 million and change, and this next fiscal FY16, you're requesting a $92 million allotment. Is that correct? Or a $92 million
general undesignated allocation? Through the chair, Representative Chief, correct. The undesignated general fund request for the Marine Highway System was $123.7 million in fiscal 13. The request in fiscal 17 is for $92.1 million and change.
And then if I'm reading this right, that if, in fact, you'd receive the $92 million and change, you'd be down below the FY10 allotment of $97,583,000 or so. Is that correct? You'd be even below 2010 numbers.
Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, that is correct.
And then it would also, I would assume, we're not factoring increased inflation costs and things like that. I mean, that all has to be a part of that $92 million. So really, the $92 million compared to the $97 back in FY10 would probably be more like spending power of $80 million maybe, or even $85, something like that.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's correct. I don't know the financial impact of dollars and inflation between those two numbers, but yes, those are real-world decisions that have real-world impacts on the level of service that the Marine Highway System is going to be able to deliver.
Thank you.
We've got a question from Representative Nagyak.
What is the exempt employees, the five of them?
Through the chair, Representative Nagyak, the exempt employees are not represented by a union. I serve at the pleasure of the commissioner. If I don't do a good job today and he says, you're done, go home, I'm done.
Okay.
No union representation.
Yeah. Thank you.
No pressure there today.
No pressure. Okay, workforce statistics. So those are the unions that represent all of the employees, both shoreside and vessel, for the Marine Highway System. The number of employees category has a footnote on it, and I want to point that out. That includes all employees, part-time, full-time, seasonal, and on-call. So these numbers are larger than what you might expect and are larger than if you went out and did a head count of how many masters, mates, and pilots we have working right now. You would not count 108 heads. These numbers were put in here to represent, it's fiscal year 14 data, how many employees we had in fiscal year 14. So if an employee came in, worked for a few months, and then left, and we got another employee, that count's going to show both of those employees, even though we only filled one position. So it's not a FTE count, it's a head count of how many people actually work for us during that year. The next column over, average cost per employee, also has a footnote. It includes salaries and benefits for full-time employees only. We took out the part-times, the seasonals, the on-calls. This number just represents the average cost to the state for each of the full-time employees in each of these unions. That number is not their take-home salary. It includes their pay and all their benefits, health insurance, retirement benefits, and all the other pay and benefits that employee costs the state. Okay? And then the annual cost for that entire contract is listed. Basically, the number of employees times the cost per employee is how much that labor contract costs the state. So $54 million of the state's budget for the Marine Highway System goes to fund IBU labor force, about $17 million for the engineers, about $17 million for the masters, mates, and pilots, and $10 million total for all the shoreside.
We've got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So looking at those average costs per employee under the, let's talk about the Marine Engineers Union, you say the average cost is $181,000 a year and some change. Tell me again what goes into those costs.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I would be glad to. So I talked with my business manager specifically about that. And these are the factors that are factored into that number. So it's regular pay, holiday pay, overtime, holdover pay, late arrival pay, early callback pay, leave, travel pay, minimum guarantees, penalty pays, retirement contributions, training contributions, health care premiums, unemployment contributions, workers' compensation contributions, Medicare contributions, and the Alaska Supplemental Benefit Retirement Plan contributions. Not all of those apply to every union. Those are the range of pays that are included in that, pays and benefits, based on labor contracts. Some of those apply to some unions, some apply to other unions. So that's not necessarily a detailed, exhaustive list for exactly the Marine Engineers, but those are the pays and benefits that were included in those computations.
Okay, so I would assume that some of those costs then would be, they're not just a result of the bargained agreement, they're a result of management's decisions to pay overtime versus paying another employee or something like that. Evidently, it's more cost effective to pay the overtime and the call time than it would be to hire another employee, I would assume. Otherwise, you wouldn't make that decision.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, sometimes it's not an if. It's not an option. I mean, sometimes you have people work overtime because the ship got delayed getting into port, and you pay overtime for that amount of time until you can replace that crew member. There are a variety of factors that play into how much overtime gets paid. I mean, we attempt to, not 100% successful, attempt to minimize the amount of overtime that we pay. We would rather have a full workforce getting normal pay rather than a smaller workforce working extra hours getting additional overtime pay, but there are a lot of challenges associated with doing that.
But wouldn't it also be true, wouldn't it also be true that in some situations, if you're talking about a new employee, you're also talking about medical benefits, retirement benefits, things like that, and you're only doing that one time for that person you're paying the overtime to, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And the question was also asked, so summarize on the total cost of CBAs. Again, in terms of whether the shoreside staff of the Marine Highway System is, I use the term bloated because I've heard that many times, you know, we're bloated on the shoreside, we should just cut the shoreside staff and put more people on the vessels and we'd fix our budget problems. You can see, again, essentially $90 million goes to vessel employee labor, $10 million or one-tenth of that goes to shoreside labor, kind of in line with the 88% of our budget is for vessel operations, 12% of our budget is for the overhead. The question was also brought up earlier about how many non-resident employees are there. Based on the work schedules of the maritime unions that work on the ships, it is possible for them, unlike a person that works in Ketchikan at the office who's there every day, you could not live out of state. A vessel employee who works 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, or 28 days on, 28 days off, or a week on, week off, can, at their choosing, decide to live outside the state. And those are the percentages of non-Alaska residents in each of those three unions that we have. So Marine Engineers, for example, about 100 employees, about 24% or 25 people, essentially do not live in the state of Alaska. Those folks that do not live in the state of Alaska do not collect cost of living differential, or COLD. COLD is payable only to employees who live within the state of Alaska. That's annually certified and verified and followed up on quite aggressively to make sure that we pay COLD to people who are entitled to COLD.
A question from Representative Hughes.
Is there a hiring preference if you're an Alaska resident? Would you... is that taken into consideration, or is that not? And I'm just wondering if, you know, if you do the numbers, I don't know what the number, like, might be 40, 50 people out of state. Do you happen to know offhand whether most of them were Alaskans that eventually realized, oh, with this schedule, I could live somewhere else, or were they hired as out-of-state residents?
Peter Cochair, Representative Hughes. We do have a hiring preference for Alaskans, and we attempt to hire Alaskans. Unfortunately, we have a hard time finding enough qualified employees to apply to fill all of our jobs from Alaska, so we end up going to the lower 48 to recruit and hire some people.
Got a question from Representative Ortiz.
And maybe it's along the same lines of what you just commented on, but in this particular, you know, where you're competing for people with these skills around the world, let's talk about you know, masters, mates, and pilots. Is it getting difficult to recruit and find people who want to work for the Alaska Marine Highway System as pilots, et cetera, based on the, you know, my understanding is that there's more and more shipping activity around the world, more and more call demand for that. So can you answer that question?
Through the co-chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, there is demand for those skills, and there is competition for those skills. I will say that in conjunction with all of the visits, community engagement meetings that I held in the community with the public, I also held a bunch of meetings on board our ships, meeting with our crews. And one of the messages that I got from that was not only does uncertainty in funding and uncertainty in the number of ships and uncertainty in the scheduling for the Marine Highway System upset the apple cart with regards to economies and communities, it also upsets the apple cart with regard to our employees who wonder whether they're going to have a job in the following year or not, or whether their ship is going to get laid up and the workforce is going to get reduced. So that does cause uncertainty and employee issues with regards to longevity. We've had quite a few folks leave the Marine Highway System to seek maritime work elsewhere. Southeast Pilots Association, for our Masters, Mates, and Pilots, for example, gets a lot of people from us, and we bring people in at the bottom and train them to refill those positions, and that's expensive.
We've got a question from Representative Millett, and then from Co-Chair Hughes.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. It's a great presentation. Can you walk me through what the training is and the training costs are for a pilot, master pilot, and just can you walk through the costs and where the training facilities are, and do they train in Alaska?
Through the co-chair, Representative Millett, I can, but there's a variety of different paths, so it's not a set path. Generally speaking, we get our masters, mates, and pilots from maritime academies, California Maritime Academy, Maine Maritime Academy, or military service, people who have gotten their license, worked in military service, that have come to work for the Marine Highway System and come in as, say, a second mate, worked their way up, or third mate, worked their way up to second mate, chief mate, and eventually to master. The training for that takes a variety of forms. We do use some training at AVTEC up in Seward that's available, but as part of our labor contract with the Masters, Mates, and Pilots Union, the state actually contributes to MITAGS, and I'm going to try and remember what MITAGS stands for, the Maritime Institute for Training and Graduate Studies in Baltimore, Maryland. It's essentially the Masters, Mates, and Pilots training school for ship drivers, and we send people there because we essentially pay for it through the labor contract to allow our employees to be able to go and take advantage of that training. To get additional qualifications and improve their license to be working their way up towards master. Pilotage, on the other hand, requires actually operating and sailing in the water. So somebody who comes to work for us initially has no pilotage. As they work on vessels going up and down Lynn Canal, for example, and getting familiar with that waterway, they can then sit for their pilotage exam with the Coast Guard, which essentially involves drawing the maritime chart from memory of all the navigation aids, hazards, obstructions, etc., to earn their pilotage for that particular area. That's a different process, not formal schooling, to get the pilotage.
And you mentioned, you said there was a cost to the state. Could you tell me per person what that cost is? And is there any, when the state provides training like that, is there any responsibility or any union contract that requires them to stay in the state, working for the state for an amount of time to basically repay that training investment?
Through the co-chair, Representative Millett. That is spelled out in the Masters, Mates, and Pilots Collective Bargaining Agreement. I don't know the number right off the top of my head, but it's a per employee, per day dollar amount that is contributed by the state to fund that school, the MITAG school.
Okay. And can you point to me where in your budget that in your, you gave us the budget page, can you tell, show me where that decrement is?
Through the co-chair, Representative Millett. For training in particular, I don't know off the top of my head. I'm assuming it's in personal services, but I would have to get back to you on that with certainty. I do not know.
And I'll just add to that, wondering whether, since you're having to recruit out of state for some of these particular talents and specialties, is there any effort to reach down into the high schools or through the Department of Labor, Department of Education, trying to let young people know that there are these opportunities so maybe some of them would consider getting involved?
To the co-chair, we have reached out to some extent, not a great amount, to try and encourage that. The workforce modeling, we used to send dispatchers to job fairs, to recruitment events, to try and foster and bring that talent in to the Marine Highway system. We don't do that probably as much as we should, but there is some of that.
Okay, thank you. You can continue.
Okay, so workforce statistics, I think that's all I want to cover on that one. Budgetary constraints, this is really just a summary between fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 15, where, you know, there's a $16 million less state operating general fund, and there's $4 million less in the state capital general fund from one year to the next. That's a pretty significant reduction. That is, as I mentioned, the reason that the motor vessel Taku, which was removed from service in June of 2015 due to insufficient capital funding, remains out of service. We simply don't have the budget to overhaul that vessel, nor the budget to actually put it into operation and run it. Fuel-based budget, I'll just mention briefly, the Department of Transportation and the Marine Highway in particular uses a lot of fuel, about 10 million gallons of diesel fuel a year. We're budgeted at $2.56 a gallon for that. Currently, the average price that we're paying is less than that, which is a good thing, which means our fuel budget is met. If the price of fuel goes up above that, where it has been most of the time, we end up with a budget shortfall due to fuel. Most of you are probably familiar with the fuel trigger that happens. So if the price of North Slope crude is above $70 a barrel, a fuel trigger kicks in to help offset the additional cost of fuel. There is no fuel trigger this year. There's not likely to be a fuel trigger for any time in the future based on that high threshold. So assuming prices stay below $2.56 a gallon, we're going to be good on our fuel budget. If prices rise above that, which they certainly could due to any number of world events, and the price of fuel might go up, might go down. Currently it's down, which is good. But that is a risk factor for us as well without a fuel trigger. So.
Representative Millett?
Historically, thank you, Co-Chair. Historically, the fuel trigger, how often has it been used? And I know, I mean, oil's been below 70 for one year. So can you, is there a place that we can look at it? Can you give us a chart of your fuel costs? Because you say that they could go up, but we hear gloom and doom on the other side when we're talking about our budget that it's not going to go up. So it's even forecasted to go as low as 20, so that would be, I think that would be a big cost savings to you. What is, you know, can you, how do you buy your fuel? Do you buy it in bulk? What do you, how do you manage that fuel capacity?
Through the co-chair, Representative Millett, I'll kind of answer those in reverse order. We don't buy fuel in bulk. We don't have any fuel storage facilities. We essentially pay market price, like you would go to the gas station and fill up your car. We call Petro Marine Services and whatever port we fuel, have them bring the truck down and take on 10,000 gallons of fuel and pay the going price in that particular port. So our fuel prices vary port to port. Pretty cheap down in Bellingham, Washington. We try to fuel up down there when ships are down there. A little more expensive than the Valdez's and the Homers of the world because it's expensive to get it there. We do not fuel forward fund or hedge or lock in long-term contracts because just as easily as prices can go up and that can save you money, prices can go down and that can cost you money. So we pay market rate for fuel. We have used the fuel trigger almost every year up until this last year. And, in fact, we actually used the fuel trigger this year even though there wasn't one because there was excess money in an account, leftover fuel trigger money. That is what essentially bailed out our summer schedule last summer and allowed us to fund that schedule. There was $7 million, I think, of excess fuel trigger money that was appropriated into the Marine Highway System fund to operate last summer. So we have made extensive use of the fuel trigger. I don't have the exact numbers Some are listed on there, but we can get you a rundown of the fuel trigger amounts each year that have kicked in. There was two triggers a year, most years, and each of those triggers put money into the Marine Highway System Fund.
And where do you recognize that fund transfer from the fuel trigger to operations of the Marine Highway? Where do you show that additional $7 million
that,
in the budget?
Through the co-chair, Representative, no, that is actually shown on this slide right here. Is this $7.179 million additional fuel trigger appropriation line in fiscal year 15?
Great, thank you.
Yep.
And I will ask, is that item fuel trigger at zero in the governor's proposed budget this year?
Through the co-chair, I'm not sure I understand the question. Is there
going to be a pot of money for fuel trigger, or is it just going to be at zero this year?
The co-chair, no, that was one-time money. That funding was there because the price of fuel went down, the fuel trigger kicked that money in, it wasn't needed, it was saved. It was a good thing it was saved because it was definitely needed this year to run this past summer schedule, but that was one-time money. There is no remaining pot of that money available to assist.
And the governor's not planning to, okay.
There's no fuel trigger to generate it, so. Okay. Workforce statistics, budgetary constraints, and non-service reductions. So one point that I like to make during these, as particularly with the community, is that a lot of people have the impression that the minute the legislature cuts the Marine Highway's budget, the first thing we do is find a ship and say, you're going to get laid up and you're going to park and we're going to save money by not running that ship. And that's actually not true. That's the last thing we try to do is lay up a ship and impact service levels and impact Alaskans. The first thing we do is we look for other efficiencies. And I just want to run through this quick list with you of all the efficiencies that we've implemented to try and save money that do not impact essential service. So we've eliminated non-essential and non-self-supporting services such as bars and gift shops on ships. There were 25 or so people associated with providing those services. They don't do that function anymore. They were distributed back out into the fleet. We hired fewer people in the bottom, so we didn't lay anybody off as a result of that. But we have saved money by not having those amenities on board the vessel. They did not self-support. We've eliminated the commercial marketing contract. We used to hire a commercial marketer to promote the Marine Highway System. We have eliminated that to the tune of $500,000 contract a year. We've eliminated funding for commercial backfill service. It used to be that when we put a vessel into a maintenance period, we would hire a commercial vessel like Allen Marine to run a catamaran to provide some service to the remote villages. We had a $200,000 line item in the budget for that. We've eliminated that as a cost savings measure. We've eliminated 30 shoreside positions. About half of those positions were on-call, part-time positions at the ferry terminals to assist with vessel tie-up, staging, and those types of things. We've eliminated all those. We are now down to the point at our terminals with staffing that we have exactly enough people to safely tie up a ship, and if one of those people is absent, we have problems. We start falling below minimum manning levels to tie up a ship. So we've cut the terminal staff to the bone. We've eliminated 15 shoreside positions, including some high-paid full-time year-round positions, a port engineer, a port captain, several folks out of the reservation system, reservations office, a marketing staff person, and several other administrative people within the Ketchikan central office.
And were these filled positions that you eliminated?
Through the co-chair, about half of them were. I don't have the exact numbers. Some were filled, some were vacant. Some were vacant intentionally because we knew, given the budget climate, that there would be cuts coming, and we left positions that naturally became vacant without filling them in anticipation of them going away. That happened several times in the reservation center. We've installed, as I mentioned before, new engines in the Columbia. We're planning on putting new engines into the Matanuska. We have fuel management systems fleet-wide on our vessels, basically an auto throttle or an autopilot. You know, tell the system when you need to be at your next port, and it will manage your speed to get you there on time, not early burning a lot of extra fuel, not late so you're messing up the schedule. That system doesn't quite work as well as one would imagine because we're not transiting in open ocean. We're transiting through a bunch of straits and narrows that have a bunch of different currents, and that fuel computer system has no idea that when you round the next corner you're going to have a 4-knot head current instead of a 4-knot tail current. So it's not perfect. I think the more important message that we heard from the shipboard meetings that I held in December from our ship drivers is we just need to slow down a little bit. Instead of trying to schedule the ship running full speed to make a 6-hour run, we need to schedule that as a 6.5 or a 7-hour run, throttle back a little bit and save fuel that way, give the masters discretion to adjust their speed accordingly. And we're going to be looking at that as we write our new schedules. We have eliminated the printed schedule. We used to put out a nice little book with a picture on it and printed schedules. That's a good thing to eliminate to save $50,000 of mailing and distribution costs, because that schedule is essentially outdated the minute we printed it with schedule changes and all that type of stuff. Everything is online now, real time. We've reduced our risk management costs.
I'm going to just make a comment.
Okay.
The ferry was bringing many of our vehicles from Homer the other day, and it didn't come in Sunday. And I went online, and it was showing up. Monday was a holiday, and it was showing up online as coming in that evening, and we went out there, and it was not coming in. It hadn't been adjusted online, so I just, it was a holiday, I understand, but it should have been adjusted, and I know someone out there.
Through the co-chair, your point is well taken. It seems that delays and schedule interruptions happen at the least convenient times, but that's something that we should be able to deal with. That was a weather delay on the Tustamina coming across the Gulf of Alaska. Actually, both of the cross-Gulf runs that we've run so far have been delayed significantly by 24 to 36 hours due to excessive sea conditions out in the Gulf. There is on our website a real-time vessel tracker. So even though the message was wrong, and I acknowledge that it was, as to when that vessel would arrive, in the lower right-hand corner of our homepage is the vessel tracker. You can actually watch the vessel moving across the ocean and see how close it's getting to Juneau to know when to pick up your vehicle. So we're trying to provide that level of information, and we haven't got 100% yet. So.
Representative, what?
I know you have two more bullets, but just a couple questions on your 25 vessel positions. How many of those were actual bodies or PCNs? How many PCN did you eliminate PCNs, or did you eliminate employees out of that 25 for the bars and gift shop? Were they all filled at the time you deleted the positions?
Through the co-chair, Representative Millett, the PCN counts on vessels are complex, and let me explain that. So only five ships had bars, mm-hmm. So there was five bartender positions that were eliminated. But those five bartender positions are filled by 12 PCNs. There's an A crew bartender, there's a B crew bartender, and there's a relief bartender, just like there is for every position on the vessel. So it essentially takes 2.3 people to fill each position on the ship when you consider the A crew, the B crew, and the relief crew.
Okay.
So that 25 is a composite number. Did we actually, those positions were all filled. The bars were up and operating until we closed them. So there were people filling those positions. Those individuals in those positions changed to other jobs, cashiers, passenger service workers, whatnot, and we hired fewer people in the bottom of the system because we distributed some from the bartender and cashier positions.
Follow-up? Mm-hmm. So that was a 25 vessel positions. Of the 30 shoreside positions, how many of those were actual bodies that you laid off? What I'm trying to get to is how many people actually physically lost their jobs, and then my second part of that question is how many open PCNs do you currently have that are unfilled? I'd like that number.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Millett, I don't have the open PCN list right now. We'll have to get that to you later, so we'll put that on the list. In terms of the 30 positions, how many were actually filled? The on-call, and so half of them, the on-call part-time positions that we laid off at the ferry terminals, were essentially all filled, but they're on-call people. We intentionally kept those folks on during the summer and laid them off effective 1 October rather than 1 July.
So they're part-time positions?
Part-time positions. So those were all filled, but in a part-time manner, on-call people. For the other 15 on the shore side, I don't have the exact numbers. We can get those for you. My estimate is we laid off and sent at least 5 people that were filled positions home out of those. The rest of them were probably vacant. But as I mentioned to Representative Hughes, vacant knowing that cuts were coming. So why would we hire somebody to fill a vacant position knowing that cuts were coming and we're going to lay them off? So we left some vacant intentionally.
And just one last question. If I could get the vacancy amount of PCM numbers you have within the Marine Highway System. And what I'm hearing you say is that five employees were laid off. None of them retired early or so they... I'm trying to find out actually what the layoff status was, if you actually laid people off or they took early retirement or you you put them in some other positions like you did the bartenders.
Through the chair, Representative Miller, mostly the latter. We did not lay off people and say, we're sorry, we don't have a job for you, you're leaving, to the maximum extent possible, because we tried to take care of our employees. So we'll get to those exact numbers. I don't have them.
Representative Ortiz.
And going back to those positions, two questions. On the gift shop folks, it was my understanding that the way that those gift shops were operated was that they were not just gift shop operators. They did other duties on the ship as well as opening the gift shop for a few hours a day. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Representative Ortiz, that is correct. They were not strictly cashiers in the gift shop.
Okay, so they would normally fill their day with other duties as assigned.
Right. Correct, to the extent they could within work rest requirements.
Right, okay. And then, I've done a lot of talking and communicating with different, ferry employees. One of the things that they consistently brought up in my conversations is that while the bars overall might not have done well, that there were some runs where the bars were at least cost neutral, if not made some money. Would you agree with that?
Through the co-chair, Representative Ortiz, I don't know if I would agree with that. The issue with the bars is not that they did not generate revenue. Clearly, the bars generated revenue because they sold alcoholic beverages and they brought in money. The bars did not make a profit for the system because when you factored in the cost of the fully burdened, fully pensioned, fully health care, full state employee bartender with full benefits and no tips, because tipping is prohibited by state law, it was not cost effective. The bars were losing money.
All of them were losing money.
Essentially all
of them, the runs.
Yes. Now, so to clarify, potentially on, say, the Columbia coming out of Bellingham with a very full ship and a very full load on a summer day, could that bar have potentially broke even for that short amount of time? Potentially, yes. I don't have the exact details on that. But in general, the bars as a whole lost $750,000 a year.
Thank you.
And as follow-up to that, I don't think it's been implemented long enough, the closure of the bars, to know if it's going to impact ridership. I was just wondering if some people will choose not to go on the ferry if it's a run, and they'll say, I'm going to hop a plane instead. Do you know, are you expecting?
I have heard at every community meeting I've attended that people like the bars. They enjoyed that amenity. But once I had the opportunity to explain to them why they did not make money, and told them that I had a very hard time sitting in front of this committee to tell them that we needed to have bars on ships and paid bartenders when our essential mission is to provide transportation, most people understand that.
Okay. Thank you.
I don't think it will drastically impact our ridership.
Okay, continue.
Okay, last few bullets on the non-service cost reductions. Printed schedule's gone. Risk management. The state of Alaska, as you know, is self-insured, but not our vessels. The risk of running vessels in a marine environment is high. We have commercial liability policies through risk management, Department of Administration. We've managed to reduce the cost on those some. And we have done some consolidation. We used to lease warehouse space down in Bellingham to store all of our spare parts as part of the marine engineering facility that was purchased, developed, and implemented down in Ketchikan. That building has a warehouse in it, and we moved all of those parts and supplies up from Bellingham to Ketchikan and are now stored there and reduced our lease cost space down in Bellingham.
I just want to point out that we've got about 5 minutes. So,
thank you for that. These items all reduce the blue bar. That's how we make that blue bar shrink. The next slide is how we make the red bar go up on the cost versus revenue slide. So we've altered our cancellation and change fee policies. We used to have very liberal, very lenient policies in terms of people being able to cancel at the last minute, very little or no penalty, and we'd essentially sail that space empty because we couldn't resell it in time before the ship sailed. We've changed our policies to to encourage that a reservation that gets made is a reservation that gets used, and the closer to the sailing date that is canceled, we extract some revenue in terms of a change fee or a penalty for that. We've eliminated all travel agent commissions. That saved about $1.5 million a year on the second batch of that. We've done that in two steps, but now we pay zero travel agent commissions across the board. We've done some tariff equalization implementation. Essentially, and I think I've said this in other hearings, the Marine Highway tariff structure has a lot of anomalies in it, has a lot of inequities in it, and it's not very explainable. And I, as the head of the system, cannot explain to you why, for example, it costs $35 to go 130 miles on one run and $50 to go 22 miles on a different run. It makes absolutely no sense. We're trying to fix that. Our plan is to level those tariffs, formalize those tariffs, and make it such that there is a standardized process by which tariffs are set. That is all in the works. We have eliminated or altered certain discount programs. We used to have driver goes free programs. We used to have 30% mirror round trip discounts. We've eliminated those because, as you could see from our traffic numbers are relatively flat or going down. So these discounts to encourage more people to ride were essentially a rebate to the users of the system. They did not result in spikes in ridership or vehicles being transported. So we've eliminated them as a cost savings measure. 17 and beyond promote the system as a important part of Alaska's transportation system. It serves much more than just southeast or southwest Alaska. Yes, sir.
Oh, sorry. We've got a question from Representative.
I'll make this real quick. I noticed in your revenue enhancements, are you also addressing your commercial rates? I know that there's a lot of coastal communities that are fishing communities that use the ferry to ship their fish out as opposed to using the commercial carrier because it's so much cheaper.
Through the co-chair, Representative Suits, we have. We implemented on the 1st of November a 20% commercial tariff increase across the board on commercial vehicles. So that is a result of the fiscal year or 2015 study on the AMHS rate study. We are well below standards in terms of that, so we have done some increases there.
Thank you. I'm sorry I missed that.
And just to point out here, we do have about 3 minutes before folks have to get to their next committee. What I'm thinking is we did not get anybody who signed up to testify, but if members of the committee have questions, maybe if you could finish up your presentation and then folks do have questions, we could forward those on to the department and get the answers back to folks.
I can, Mr. Co-Chair. So for 2017 and beyond, you can read the bullet points there. We're essentially trying to do several things. Reduce cost, increase revenue, reduce the fleet size, because I think we have more vessels than we can afford to operate. Two things on the bottom that I want to mention. Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan needs to be updated. That plan is woefully outdated and needs an update. That will be worked on, I think, as soon as the Juneau Access decision is made as to what's going to happen with that road project. And then the last bullet point there is the economic impact study. We had a economic impact study of the Alaska Marine Highway System done in 1995. We have hired the same company that did that to update that for the current time frame. I have the final draft of that on my desk, and we'll be sharing that with the legislature here in short order as soon as that gets finalized. So you can expect to see that in your inbox shortly. And then lastly, and the commissioner hit on this at the very beginning, and I'm glad he did, what did we hear when we went out to the communities? And I'll tell you loud and clear, first and foremost, people want and need a reliable, dependable schedule. Turmoil in the transportation business is bad for business, it's bad for reservations, it's bad for everybody. Threats of we're going to cancel a bunch of sailings are bad, just the threat of it. Putting out a schedule, being able to publish a schedule, and then actually sail that schedule is critically important to not only the Marine Highway System and our ridership, but to all the businesses and communities and economies that depend on that. There was a lot of talk about, you know, additional fees. People are willing to pay more for better ferry service, but they expect better ferry service to pay more, not pay more for worse service. Communities and economies develop with the promise of Marine Highway service. I'll mention Cordova specifically because I had the largest turnout of any community meeting I had in Cordova. We had 110 people show up that night for that meeting in a building that was originally designed to be compatible with the fast ferry homeported in Cordova. So now we're not homeporting a fast ferry in Cordova. that is an impact to the community. They built a convention and visitor center kind of based on the amount of traffic that that vessel could bring them, and now we are unable to provide that vessel there continually on a year-round basis, or even in the summer for some parts of it. That is a challenge. That's an impact to communities. The rest of the bullet points, I think, are self-explanatory, and the entire report from all those community engagement meetings is available on the Marine Highways website. This is kind of the distilled version of it, but all the comments are available on the website.
Great. Well, I appreciate your presentation. I think folks need to get off to the next meeting, but again, if there are questions, please forward them to the co-chairs, and we'll get the answers back to folks. And again, thank you very much. We'll adjourn here at 3:01 p.m.